Okay, let's get ready here by pausing for a few moments of silent prayer. For those of you who are sinning now, you need rebound, and we will move forward in our study. Shall we pray? Now, Father, we thank you for this opportunity, an opportunity that is under threat. And therefore, we must capitalize upon these opportunities as they remain. And as we do, it is imperative that we use it to grow in grace, to move forward in our spiritual life, to acquire that level of spiritual sophistication that would enable us to apply what we know to the exigencies of our environment. It is our prayer that what we do here this morning will contribute to that objective, and we lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. We are studying Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 and following, and we have made progress in that, and I want to go back and note the extended translations as far as we've gone. We go back to Matthew 22, 15. Then the Pharisees convened to devise a plot to entrap Jesus in his speech. And they sent their star students to him, along with representatives of the Herodian party, who from public and temple records knew Jesus was the rightful heir to the throne of Judea, saying, "Esteemed theologian, we know from a process imposed throughout our elite level of theological training that you are truthful, unable to lie, and teach the manner of life and conduct of God by means of his integrity and rectitude. And you are unintimidated by anyone, including Tiberius, for you are not one to show favoritism to anyone. Tell us then, what is your personal opinion? Is it lawful to pay property tax to Tiberius or not?" But Jesus was caused to perceive their malice and said to them, "Why do you examine me, hypocrites?" On Thursday, as we were closing, we engaged the next verse, chapter 22, verse 19. The Lord responds, "Show me the coin used for the poll tax." And they brought him a denarius. Now, the Herodians were not religious, but political, as their name suggests. Their primary concern was protecting the Herodian dynasty. This is something that was presently held by Herod Antipas. This is one of the sons of Herod the Great, whom we studied during the examination of Matthew chapter 2 a little over a year ago. The scribes are the students of the Pharisees. These are the ones that are over in the cemetery, and they're being taught the oral law. You had to memorize this, and so there's a lot of memory work involved. I was talking to Lou about Gabe the other day. He tells me that Abe is what they call in the movie business a quick study, that he can be given his part in a given scene and take a look at it for just a few minutes and then go out there and do it verbatim. And so he was quizzed by Lou as to how he was able to do such a thing. And he said, "All of that doctrine you made me memorize." That's what really is going on here. These guys obviously had phenomenal memory. They had to memorize things that were not in print, but rather conveyed to them by the Pharisees. The scribes who were Pharisees. And these scribes taught at the cemetery. I just got a letter from someone calling my use of the word cemetery verbicide of seminary. But it is a cemetery where guys with the gift of pastor teacher go to die as effective communicators of the word. We've got a young man in our church who honestly believes he has the curse and has engaged and enrolled in a cemetery online. And he comes to me with the things that he's being taught. And I said, "Well, remember, it's a cemetery. Don't die there. The way that you grow in grace, no matter where you are or what you engage, is by personal study. Train yourself. The information is there. I've got so many books now, I need more bookcases. My mother used to ask me, have you read all of these books? I said, well, first of all, no, and secondly, I don't intend to. And she was shocked by that. And she said, well, why do you have them? I said, they have indices. I can find what I need in that book without reading the whole thing. And then I bring it to you. Although it's illegal, I've been told. You're looking at possibly a person that's going to be arrested. I'm going to be sent to Marion. The church will be, all this money will be taken away. And we'll be able to sell this place as a funeral home. Nevertheless, I believe that the research that others have done and those that do the research, I've given full attribution, is information that you need that amplifies what we study from those who've done the research. Now, I'm trying to move over in the way I prepare my lessons. Rather than give attribution, I've become a plagiarist. So nobody knows that I'm stealing. I read. I'd have to take the time to read. I make notes. And then I put all of what I've just learned in my own words. And that's trying to stay out of jail. These scribes have these students, and they are training them day by day by day to memorize the Talmud, which at that time was the oral law. And we'll get into some of the Talmud in our study if I'll shut up and go on. We may get into it today. And I'm going to show you, and it's a part of amplifying a section of our study to do this. But when we get there, you'll see something that you're going to think is very boring. But there's an aspect of it that ties in centrally to this discussion our Lord's having with these students and with the Herodians. Therefore, we learn from this that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Jesus Christ had two enemies, the Herodians and the scribes. And therefore, the scribes and the Herodians could be friends and therefore team together to try and discredit Jesus before Tiberius, of all people, who would have him executed if somehow they can coax him, trick him, trap him into giving the incorrect response to their ultimate question. Now, I was talking with Casey beforehand, and I'm going to give you some conjecture. Remember when I conjectured a lot back in the star study? Well, this is conjecture. I believe that a personality like Jesus, who came on the scene and was conducting miracles, had phenomenal wisdom, every time challenged by these experts, he was able to give the kind of answer that shut them up, the kind of answer filled with wisdom. He was able to go into the temple as a young boy at 12 years of age and carry on extensive, in-depth discussions with these experts. And as an adult now moving into his public ministry, he has perfected all of the knowledge that is necessary to get to the cross and knows how to manage the zeitgeist and the environment and the cultural aspects of his day. And to do so in a way that nobody could get to him, although I think that since he was a controversial figure in and out of Jerusalem, up in Galilee on occasion and down in Jerusalem on occasion, and was well known and was controversial and was being touted as the Son of God and the prophesied Messiah. If you were in a position of power as these Pharisees are, as others in the Sanhedrin, including the Sadducees, scribes, and so on, if your job is to communicate the law and otherwise communicate to the people what the Old Testament or the Tanakh has to say, would not you have been curious if he had a legitimate claim? And could you not have gone to the temple and done some investigation of all of the records that were open to anyone's purview and therefore prove whether or not he had a legitimate claim to the throne of David? And if you were in the Herodian dynasty and you were not a Jew, and therefore you wondered if there was a legitimate claim to your throne by this man touted as the Messiah, would not you have gone to the public records which were available to anyone to peruse, and determine there whether or not he had a legitimate claim. So I'm saying to you by conjecture that what these people were afraid of was that he was possibly the Messiah, and they had to get rid of him. And that's what this plot is all about. If he can be executed, then he's removed from the scene. The Herodian throne has therefore been preserved, and the scribes can maintain their power over the people. People who do not have capacity for authority, once given it, become arrogant. They love the power, and they will do anything to maintain it. Now, Jesus never referred to Tiberius by name. He never opposed Roman rule. He challenged those who subscribed to the oral law over the Mosaic law, which included these people in front of him, namely the scribes and their students. As author of the law, he had a right to do this. Now he's confronted by strange bedfellows whose obvious objective is to put him at odds with the rule of the Roman Empire. To challenge Tiberius would be equal to challenging the authority of God, which his mission did not allow. Now note that he did not challenge the authority of the Roman throne. It was not his job. We're going to see things occur in this passage and our evaluation of it that are so pertinent today you cannot believe it. And Jesus Christ is going to give the example. Do you worship and honor him? Then orient to what we're going to learn. Tiberius was indeed a monster, but a monster who was allowed to acquire power by divine approval. The zeitgeist of a nation determines the collective desire of the people. You get who you deserve, and it's all about volition. Leadership reflects that desire. This passage sums up the believer's relationship with political leaders, John 19, verses 10 through 12. So Pilate said to Jesus, "Do you not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you?" And Jesus answered, "You have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above." God writes off on who gets to be in positions of leadership. "For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin." Well, who was that? Basically, the Sanhedrin and those that they could rouse among the rabble. As a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, "If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. You're no friend of Tiberius. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Tiberius," which is what Herod Antipas freely was able to do. Rome allowed Judea to have its own king and would have allowed Jesus to be king since he was qualified to be. In verse 11, the Lord points out the legitimacy of Pilate's office, the legitimacy of Pilate's authority, which he does not challenge. Jesus willingly submitted to civil and criminal authority whenever he faced it. We obey the law, or try to. Sometimes you break the law, you don't know it. Sometimes you make every effort to do what you think is the right thing, and you're going to go to jail. Gary, I may need to follow you around to learn how to do a prison ministry. I'm sure there's a technique to it. This was illustrated by his demeanor before the squad of Roman soldiers and its commanding Kiliarch, who'd needlessly bound him following his arrest in John 18:12. He submitted to the arrest. You know, Peter thought that he would take things into his own hands, which was a sword. The high priest had his tight man there, Malchus. And I don't know why he picked on Malchus, because the Roman soldiers there, he could challenge them with his sword. But no, he went to just a functionary, chopped off his ear. And the Lord said, "We're not going to have that. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword." And so that the pacifists picked that up, having no concept of context. So he stuck his ear back on, and there's another miracle. And then the guys wanted to arrest him. He said, fine. And so the Romans came in and got him and took him to Annas, as we'll know. So he maintained his noncombative demeanor throughout the six trials he faced before both Jewish and Roman authorities. He submitted to the authority, the civil authority of the day. Submitted to it. Now, in the interviews of Pilate, what did Pilate discover? I can't find out this guy's done anything wrong. He claims to be king, and there's no king but Caesar. Now, I want you to note this is John 19, okay? And John 19 is occurring right before the trials are going to occur that night. And then he's going to be executed the next day. So that means possibly some of the people who are down there screaming, crucify him, at least knew about it. They were not involved in the exchange that we're noting. They didn't want to give money to Tiberius that had his ugly face on it. But over here, they're defending him. What sense does this make? The first visit on the Sanhedrin's search for trumped-up charges was Annas, the high priest emeritus, and father of the current high priest, Caiaphas. In fact, Annas called the shots. Caiaphas carried them out. I mean, in any criminal organization, you have a honcho, Guido, or whoever. I forget who. Lou could give a lecture on these names that run the show. But they never get their hands dirty. They have their functionaries do it. And if they get caught, then they die, and Guido's okay. Annas calls the shot, Caiaphas executes. Of course, Caiaphas is Annas' boy. The self-appointed chief theologians of the day, who were so dead set on their oral law, were complicit in the murder of the Old Testament's prophesied Messiah. Chief theologians of the day, who should have known better, they were so immersed in the oral law of the Torah, which became the Talmud, so immersed in that because they wanted everyone to become perfect, and they legislated what perfection was. And that occurs in Christian churches where the pastor and all in there want everybody to be perfect. And that therefore they have watchdogs, clipboard committee. Clipboard committee finds out you haven't been perfect, then that has to be straightened out. And what it winds up is being extreme legalism. Everybody's afraid to move, won't say anything. Why talk? The delatores may be in the walls. Self-righteous Jews and career politicians have united in an evil conspiratorial cabal to carry out a plan they hoped would entrap the Lord before the ultimate power of the empire, Tiberius Caesar. They want to entrap him. Let Tiberius get rid of our problem. And if we can coax him into applying the second commandment to our question, then we got him. Pacifists who become pastors assume the Lord's submissiveness to duly appointed authorities is justification for their noncombative philosophy of life. A lot of things you can look at in Jesus' decision making during the incarnation, during his public ministry, and you look at his decisions, how he was very submissive and compliant, and therefore impute pacifism. The turning the other cheek thing, everybody loves to quote that. Well, you're not judge and jury, and in the millennium, you turn the other cheek. Lord's judge, jury, executioner, dispenser of discipline, whatever's necessary, the rod of iron would come down very heavy on such an individual. If you do not understand dispensational theology, you are going to be confused by the Bible. There are different rules and regulations for different eras of history. We are not required to go into a temple. We're not required to stand out in the front yard and sacrifice an animal. Why not? Because it's not our dispensation. Things have changed with the arrival of Christ. He has revealed a new law. He's revealed new modus operandi for a new group of people called the church. And Israel and the church are different. That's why you have the Tanakh. That's why you have the Torah. That's why you have the Talmud. That's why you have the Mishnah. That's why you have the Gemara. That's why you have all of that oral stuff that has to be memorized so you can learn how to be perfect. So maybe God will let you go to heaven when you die. And you're not going to be perfect because you were born imperfect and there's nothing you can do about it. And so this had to be revealed to people. Why did not you understand what the rituals were teaching? Why did not you know this? Those that didn't know it went on thinking they could be perfect. Let's keep the law better this year. It got all washed away at Yom Kippur. Now we can start over with a new slate. Like this, that's the annual rebound. Yom Kippur is the annual rebound. I'm going to slit the throat, let it bleed, we're done for a year. Pacifists who become pastors assume the Lord submissiveness to duly appointed authorities is justification for a non-combative philosophy of life. Their error is failure to realize that Jesus is Prince of Peace in the millennium enforced by a rod of iron. In the incarnation, Pax Romana was maintained by divinely approved human authority, which he does not challenge. Who challenged Rome in the first century? Nobody. What kind of leadership did they have? Horrible. What kind of military did they have? Fantastic. They stretched ultimately from Scotland to the Persian Gulf, incorporating a huge number of societies, races, peoples, cultures, and somehow that worked until Bread and Circus took over. Until they decided to give people stuff who didn't work for it. And when you have to open the treasuries and give people stuff they don't work for, then ultimately the others have to ante up. And when there's not enough anteing upping, then you have to devalue the money. And when you devalue the money, there's inflation. And ultimately, the money is not worth anything. And then you start getting pacifistic along the northern borders and let the Goths and the Visigoths come in from the north. And eventually, they take you down. I just got a letter from a Dorito. I just read it in the paper this morning that there's a big campaign that's going to emerge in the country by Islamic organizations with billboards and meetings and what have you, selling the idea that we should not be afraid of the infiltration of Sharia law into our society, that they're peace-loving folk. And this Dorito that I've just gotten a letter from says that there is a library in his town where he lives, and the people that visit there and sleep there and stay there have made a complete mess of it, and there's nothing done about it. Nothing happens overnight. Things gradually fade, crumble, and fall apart. The center cannot hold. Ultimately, there's too many fissures and cracks in the foundation of freedom. And in order to restore order, freedom has to be sacrificed. And I am fully convinced, beyond a shadow of any doubt I might have, that the current controversy over contraception and birth control and all of that razzmatazz is nothing but an entree into the independent status of churches and synagogues in this country. Get inside one way and you're inside all the way. The Constitution is under attack and free exercise is in the crosshairs. That's why I rail at you. Take advantage of these opportunities while you have them. We have evil people in our midst. One must understand Jesus' priorities. To seek and to save those who are lost in order to end their sin problem by making it to the cross at the appointed time. Now, the Father was managing human history during the incarnation, as he does at all times. The events that transpired were working together to culminate in the substitutionary sacrifice for human sin. It was in the plan. It was decreed. There was a process and procedure. It was prophesied. All these guys had to do was look into the Old Testament prophets. Get out of the Torah. Get out of your Talmud. Get into the prophets. They'll tell you exactly what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, and how you'll know. We're Gentiles. We can, and we know English, not Hebrew. We've got the books, and we can look in the books, and we can evaluate, and we can discover, and we can discern what the Old Testament is telling us about who the Messiah is going to be. And when Daniel gives you a clock that ticks away right down to the hour, why can't they see Daniel's clock? I don't know. Why can't they see the events of the crucifixion and those things that surrounded it in Isaiah 53? I don't know. But they're not Dufi. They can memorize the whole book. Why don't they know? Blindness, spiritual blindness, is the only explanation. Those in power are in power because the mentality of the people permitted it. If volition is free, then volition is free to be negative. Everybody has a free will, and that's the issue in the angelic conflict, and it pervades every decision that is ever made in your entire life. You are free to call your own shots. And God honors that. The whole issue is, who are you going to play for? I mean, if you're a stud muffin coming out of high school, and you are a left tackle weighing 320 pounds and run a 4.440, and both Auburn and Alabama want you to play for them, you have got to be able to tell the difference between daylight and dark, good and evil. And if you can't tell the difference, you're going to make a bad volitional decision, and God will honor it. Remember this definition of the divine decree. Now, we're going back to the thinking of God, who's known all that is knowable for all eternity, but because we cannot think on that level, we have to break things down into categories. He doesn't have to do that. So this is the definition of the divine decree. The decree of God is His eternal, holy, wise, and sovereign purpose, comprehending simultaneously all things that ever were or will be in their causes, conditions, successions, and relations, and determining their certain futurition. Now let's go back over that a moment. It says here the decree of God, and it is a singular concept. The several contents of this eternal purpose have to be evaluated by human mentality. And in order to do that, we have to perceive it in partial aspects. We have to separate it out, like build a doctrine of the divine decree and give categories and points and so on. God doesn't have to do that. So we look at it as the divine decrees, as if it were plural, but it's one thing, one decree. The decree of God is His eternal, that's self-explanatory. Holy, it says in the definition, but that brings into view His integrity, which is righteousness, justice, and love. So all of those concepts support the decree. wise is omniscience. He knows all that is knowable and is able to use that information in order to incorporate his decree for the human race. And he's sovereign, which means he has the authority to do it. The decree of God is his eternal, holy, wise, and sovereign purpose, comprehending, that's volition, comprehending, understanding, and then choosing. Comprehending simultaneously all things that ever were or will be. Comprehending it. Now listen to this. In their causes. Every cause has an effect. So therefore, cause A has effect A. And effect A becomes a cause, cause B, that results in effect B. And so it's a ripple domino effect. When you get up in the morning, you can make a decision that will have ramifications throughout your day because the decision you made is going to have consequences. It doesn't have to be bad. I'm just saying whatever decisions you make, follow this process. And therefore, it turns out that everything is one thing. And he understands that. Every decision you've ever made in your entire lifetime has brought you to this moment. Conditions are surrounding all of this. Successions, that gets into cause and effect, and therefore the things associated with those causes and effects, and how they relate to each other. Determining their certain futurition. He knows what's going to happen, and you're in this. You're in the divine decree. He knows your life. He knows your decisions. He knows what those decisions will reveal and cause, etc., etc. You're in the plan. You don't know what's going on, but he does. How does he know? Because of omniscience. He's eternal. He's not limited by tenses. There's no past, present, and future for him except in his management of the human race. He's able to know what your decisions are going to result in somewhere way down the road, all the way to the day you die, and made a plan for you. Who can do this? Somebody with omniscience. So God has a plan. And as the psalmist wrote in Psalm 76:10, the wrath of man shall praise you. Even the horrible, God-awful things that occur ultimately praise God. How's that going to happen with us? He knows what he's doing. It's all in the decree. And he is a very patient God. He lets those who need to be exposed expose themselves. And then volition, usually, the law of volitional responsibility will ultimately take over. And in the end, he's praised. Now, as corrupt as the various religious factions were in Jerusalem, the Lord never challenged the office of anyone, but he did challenge their thinking. You have to be completely dismissed from society and what's going on not to form some kind of an opinion of what's prevalent in the current culture and zeitgeist. Although there's some doubt. I had a friend send me a quiz that you could take to determine how you understood current events. So I took it. It had 13 questions. I took the thing. I got all 13. You would have too. But then they have a chart in age groups as to who knew what. Now the old folks, that's me. The old folks rank the highest on the list. And the new generation, the young folks have all been to university and majored in something, were the dumbest on the list with regard to current events. They had pictures of people, you should know who they are. They didn't know who they were. They didn't know who these people were. As corrupt as the various religious factions were in Jerusalem, the Lord never challenged the office of anyone. Only their thinking. Now, as viciously evil as the political leadership was in Rome, the Lord never challenged the throne of Tiberius. Never.
duly appointed, however that worked out in the Roman Empire. In fact, he was Augustus's son, so that's how that worked out. Those who regard his alleged passivity as pacifism miss the subtle method of his message. Now ain't the time. There's a plan. I'm in the plan, and the plan's going to move forward. Cross before the crown. Therefore, he was noncombative. Why does he recommend that modus operandi for the church, for the Christian, for the believer? Why noncombativeness? Now ain't the time. We must submit to the authorities, bad as they are, but I'm telling you, I didn't bring the chart today, but you've seen it enough. I've given you the list of the Claudio Julians, given you the list of the Flavians, and with the exception of one or two, they all were absolute god-awful, horrible people. They were tyrants, murderers, perverts. Domitian, if I were to come in here and tell you, let's take a look at Domitian, who was the last emperor during the time of the development of the New Testament canon. Let's take a look at why he was a bad guy. And I would clear the room. You'd go put your hands over your children's ears. Oh, I can't let little Johnny hear that. Well, if the people, if you were alive in SPQR in the late 80s and 90s, the children knew. And you know what the children know today? People are not ashamed one iota to stand up in front of the Senate hearing in this country and confess to being a lady of the evening. Confess to it. And then want money to sustain the habit. Opioid release. So it's hard to protect the children today. We're eking and ebbing toward that. I don't know, did you see this? How do you protect your children from this? Well, you keep them inside. Put them in their room. Put earmuffs on. Forbid televisions and computers. You know, maybe stick an ice pick in their ear so they can hear nothing. Gouge their eyes out so they can't see. That's the only options you've got left. And then Protective Services comes in and takes them away because you've been mean. I was just trying to protect my child's soul. Wrong. Of course, obviously that's wrong. But what are your options? What are your options today in the corrupt, degenerate, perverted society in which we live, in which there are no morals? The Lord harbored no aspirations to sit on the throne of Rome or Judea. He understood the principle and the laws of divine establishment and the four divine institutions. He understood these. They're functional, for good or for bad. The one pertinent in our context, therefore, is honor the king. And it's mentioned in the New Testament on several occasions. Honor the king. Now, are you able to reach way down in your doctrinal inventory and pull out that concept and stick it into the biblical problem-solving devices and the Royal Family Honor Code? Some things are hard. Really hard. But I tell you this, God's in His heaven and He knows the score. He knows the facts. And he's got something on his mind. And volition will tell the tale. You leave him alone. God, I mean. Leave him alone. As long as you are a force for the light, as long as you are consistent in your inculcation, as long as you honor Christ, he is going to protect us. Even in fifth cycles, there's a remnant, which we call the pivot. You're taken care of. For example, what are you going to do with your money? You're going to buy gold? Let's buy some gold. Well, don't you know that all they have to do is do an executive order and say, oh, just turn all your gold in for 10 cents on the dollar? I've got plenty of money. Executive order. It's worth 10 cents on the dollar. If you study the Roman emperors, that's what they could do. They'd say, well, this is what we're going to do. And what are you going to say? Yathra. Therefore, when he asks for a coin, he does so in order to drive home these principles. Laws of divine establishment, the divine institutions. He's going to teach them establishment concepts that are pertinent in their day. Establishment concepts are pertinent in every dispensation. Now, the word coin is the noun nomisma, literally sanctioned by law is what that word means, sanctioned by law. It later came to mean currency, money, or coins. The Lord then signifies which denomination of this currency he wants. There is a certain coin struck by Tiberius and designated as the currency to be used for payment of this poll tax. So they'd struck a lot of coins back then. The emperors did a lot of them. They would celebrate some kind of god that needed to be celebrated and strike a coin with, whoever on it. Certain constellations, certain stars. I mean, it was ridiculous, though, they'd put on their coins. But they could do that because they were, hey, Caesar. And Tiberius wanted one that everybody had to pay with his face on it. It was called a denarius, and you added up this annual tax with a denarius. We'll get into that. The tax was called the census, and the denomination was the denarion, or in English, denarius. And this is indicated by the second sentence of the verse, Matthew 22:19. Show me the coin used for the poll tax. And the attackers brought him a denarius. Then Matthew 22:20. And he said to them, whose likeness and inscription is this? So they hand him a denarius. It's a silver coin. I'll show you a picture second session. And he holds it up. Whose likeness and inscription is this? During the reign of Tiberius, the poll tax was paid with a denarius that bore an image and an inscription. The word translated image is the noun icon. In context, the emperor's likeness struck onto the coin. The word implies that the portrait presents the physical characteristics of an individual, in this case, Tiberius. Now, the attackers brought this denarius to Jesus, which means one of them had it on his person. They're all hot and bothered and concerned about the second commandment. You shall not make any images of anything in heaven above or in earth below or in the waters beneath the earth, etc. Don't make any, no idols. Overt idolatry. You make an idol, you bow down to the idol. That's the idea. And the Jews were to avoid that as we are. Yet Tiberius, who claims to be a god, all the emperors did, he's got his face on the coin that you have to use to pay your tax. And they're quizzing him about whether, is it lawful? Is it lawful according to what? Is it lawful according to the oral law? In view of the second commandment. So what does the oral law have to say about this? And how does it relate to the second commandment? And therefore, what is this coin with Tiberius' face on it got to do with either? Well, that's what will take up second session. I can see you guys need coffee. We'll be back at 10 till the hour.